that screwed you up, right?
No, it didn't screw me up. Actually, it gave me time to think about the difference between photography now and photography in the past, comparing film versus digital. And I think the real big difference between when I was a news photographer at the Advocate and now, the film itself or the negative itself was a precious commodity. It was something that you valued. I don't know how many times the picture that ended up in the newspaper was frame number 37, because it was like, okay, I just need one more frame and I'm going to be able to make this picture happen. But the other thing about that was that it was a special position in order to be able to develop film, make a print, write a caption, and get it done quickly. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, anybody with their telephone, with their computer, with anything, they can make an image. I wouldn't say they're necessarily making a photograph, but they're making it. Anybody can make an image, and anybody can share it with anybody else. It's no longer a special item. It's no longer a precious thing. It's just an image. Mm-hmm. And I think because of that, what I see as far as what is considered to be news photography, sports photography, whatever, is diminished in its value. Maybe the quality is better in some way or another, but in terms of the value as a piece of art or as a piece of something that's valuable, it's gone downhill. Now, one of the things that I thought about, and you may get a chuckle out of this, during the time that I worked at the AAP, many times I would be called upon, because I was one of only just a handful of people there at night, I would be called upon to scan pictures of, if somebody died or whatever, you got Lindbergh or, whatever, And it always struck me when I called up our librarian and had him bring down a box full of negatives. And, I'd be going through those, trying to find the picture to send out on the wire, because invariably the first one you sent out is the one that everybody used, whether it was the best one or not. The first one was the one everybody wanted to see. And so I really thought about that. But the other thing that struck me, every time that I did one of these, I'd have a picture of somebody, shaking hands with, the President Roosevelt or whatever, here's some industrialist or whatever. And it struck me time and time again that I'm holding this negative, and this negative was there. And it's like it's traveled this route. It's traveled, maybe it was taken in Germany, it was taken in Japan, it was taken in Australia. That negative has followed that route all the way to my hands, 40, 50, 70 years later. And I'm thinking, holy cow, I am physically connected to that event and to that person. That doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing physically moving from point A to point B. It's all just electrons.
One thing that hasn't changed, but I always liked about being a photographer, is the photographer has to be there.
Well, hopefully, yeah.
Reporters can do it from a desk.
Oh, and most of the time they do, yeah.
But the photographer has to actually get his butt out there somewhere in the vicinity of whatever it is that's happening.
Well, and that's something that always amuses me, because people would ask, well, God, you know, especially when I was working at the Advocate or when I was shooting over in Columbus for the AP, you know, these high school kids would come up and they'd say, well, man, I want to be a news photographer. It's like, wow, you got the latest and greatest and biggest and strongest camera in the world. No. That isn't what it's about. I said it's about 90% of it is it being there, and the vast majority of that is driving like Mario Andretti, and then the other 10% is waiting, and about 1% of it is actually making a picture and hopefully getting it in focus.
F8 and be there.
That's right. You know, the old axiom from, which used to be actually on a piece of tape on the inside of the film cabinet at the Advocate. It said, F8 and be there. So,
wonder who put that up.
I'm not sure whether John or... Steve Pyle might have been responsible for that or whatever, but anyway, what else do you want to know?
Well, tell me some stories. I let you think about this too much, so I'm going to make some suggestions now to get you.
That's fine. That's fine.
John Ashbrook's body. Because that's one that I know, but you know.
Senator... Was it senator or representative?
Representative.
Representative John Ashbrook passed away. And interestingly, I think that was the first picture I ever had on the AP wire, because a week earlier he had spoken to a group of people here in Newark. And as far as we know, no one else had taken a picture of him in the week up until his death. And so I had, you know, the typical pose, you know, here he was pointing at something or whatever, and little teeny tiny print, and I forget how it ended up on the wire. I don't know. I think they actually sent somebody over to pick up the print. But the next week they had this huge funeral for him in his hometown of Johnstown. And I was the obviously the Advocate's representative up there, and went up and camped out with all the other photographers in front of the church, and, you know, all the senators and the representatives and the governor and everybody else parading past and snapping a picture of everybody that went in and out. And then there was huge, you know, what am I trying to say? Not cavalcade.
Entourage?
When you have a
procession
up through downtown Johnstown, you know, all the townspeople came out, stood on the street corners, and, you know, watched as a hearse went up through town to the little cemetery. And then they kept the photographers back. We were all stuck out at the side of the road with big lenses and waiting and waiting to get some kind of picture. And finally we saw his wife, so everybody got a picture of her going away, and we got, you know, a few wide shots of the crowd up there, and that was about it. So I, you know, grabbed all my stuff and drove back to Newark, and actually we stopped, I believe, at the coroner's office in Granville. And the reporter I was with, we stopped up there and spoke to him about reports that there had been toxicology investigations. They were concerned that something, you know, nefarious had happened. The coroner actually confirmed that, yes, the body was in Cincinnati, and that the funeral was not happening, or what wasn't. It was just for show. And so the reporter and I drove back up to Johnstown, and I have this priceless photo of him reaching under the flowers on the grave to look and see if there was anyone there, and there was no one there. So there you go. That's the John Ashbrook story.
Well, I remember you you and Joe being at our house on your way to Johnstown to look for a body.
Oh, yeah.
That was.
I didn't mention the name of the reporter. It was Joe Williams. Yeah. Okay. He's very proud of that photo. I was trying to think if there were any other unusual advocate
stories from the transition from analog to digital.
Oh yeah, the best thing about being in Chicago during that time span from 1990 to 1994 was, first of all, just to back up a little bit, when I was in Columbus to send a photograph, what we did was we shot it on film, processed the film, made a print, whether black and white or color, and scanned it like a high quality fax. You know, it wasn't much more than just a.
And you would do that at the scene of things like football games.
Oh yeah, yeah. Or we would rush back to the office and, you know, develop the film as fast as we could. You know, make a print as fast as we could, put it on the transmitter, press the button, and it took 10 minutes to do a black and white. Or since you did cyan, magenta, and yellow, it would take you 30 minutes to do a color picture.
This is to transmit.
To transmit it, exactly. Yeah. And so that was the standard and had been for many years when I was in Columbus. When I went to Chicago, we'd already started in scanning pictures into what they called a Leafax transmitter, which was basically turning it into a digital picture. And the computer at Chicago at that point in time was some VAX machine of some sort. It was a room-sized computer which could hold 200 black and white pictures. And one of my jobs there, because I was usually the last person out at night, was to go in and delete 100 of them to make room for the next day's pictures. Because you could only hold, you know, so many transmissions. And so I felt really bad because I knew many of these pictures, when I press that delete button, that was it. They were gone forever. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it was still about 30 minutes for color, 10 minutes for black and white. In the 4 years that I was there, we got to the point where I believe it was a minute and 28 seconds for a color picture 4 years later. And by the time I left New York 12 years after that, it was about 24 or 26 seconds basically to send any picture anywhere in the world, you know, because it was all via satellite. You just basically pressed a button on the computer and it was gone. But the transition from the analog to the digital in Chicago was really amazing, because we were kind of, I don't know, from time to time, I think they treated us as guinea pigs up there to see what would work. And one of the things that we had was one of the very first digital cameras, or practical digital cameras. One of our photographers had gone to Richard Nixon's funeral, which I believe was 1992, and he came back with two of the three Nikon NC2000s that existed at that point in time. And they cost some outrageous amount of money, like $38,000 a piece for 1 megapixel. But he walked in the door and he had those cameras there in the office for 2 weeks because he was taking them to the Kentucky Derby. And it was amazing because the people in charge said, "Go ahead, try it, see what you think." I was like, wow. I saw the future.
Right.
Even though it was very slow, it was pretty amazing to see what was coming. And so during that 4 year stretch, we did get a chance to taste everything that came along, in terms of the computers, in terms of the cameras, in terms of software. It was an exciting time, definitely.
Yeah, those cameras were all coming from Kodak back then, weren't they?
Yeah, it was a joint venture between the AP, Kodak, and Nikon, and somewhere I read the chips actually were stolen from spy satellites, and because no one had that technology, you know, I mean, it was completely new, and they made a few mistakes. The first camera had no screen on it, so you had no idea what the image looked like until you downloaded it into the computer. But I think the bigger problem with the NC2000 was the battery was fixed in the camera. And so when the battery ran dry or, you know, ran out, you had no camera until you could find an AC outlet for like 3 hours or something crazy like that. And just as a comparison, you know, you could shoot 100 or 150 pictures and that was about it, which admittedly was, you know, five rolls of film, you know, but just as a comparison, this past weekend, I finally ran down out in the field a battery in one of my D300s, and I think it was something like 1,700 frames. It still had 24% left, but it was flashing like, oh, yeah, like it's time to change the battery, and I just... It's the first time it's ever come up short.
Right.
You know, and to think that you can shoot on a little teeny tiny battery that, you know, that you just pull out, stick in another one, and you can still do another 1,500 frames or 2,000 frames. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I always have two batteries for my digital cameras, but I can't ever remember in recent years anyway having to switch them out.
That's the first time on. I've had these cameras a year and a half or 2 years, that's the first time that I've had one actually indicate that it was low in the field.
Yeah.
You know, because it goes for so long, you end up recharging it really before it needs to be recharged. But, I had a couple of cameras early on in the digital era where about 50 shots and that was it. And you were always searching for an AC outlet, you know. Just as an aside on that, nowadays you get on an Amtrak train and every one of them has an outlet on it. But 10 years ago, if you got on an Amtrak train, there was one outlet on each side of each car. And you could see the people gravitating towards that seat with the outlet.
Right.
Anyway, back to The Advocate. Oh, trying to think of exciting things at The Advocate. We had some interesting things going on here in Newark. Back then, Newark Catholic High School was, they were like state champs every year.
Right.
And you just naturally assumed you were going to the state championship every year. It was kind of a shock when they didn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with some of the basketball teams, some of the girls' volleyball teams and softball teams here in Newark were always, you know, high up there. So it was really a surprise when you didn't go. And I think one of the pictures that really struck people was there were two of them. One of them were one of the Newark team players. We were over at Fairgrounds Coliseum or something like that. He'd missed a shot with like 2 seconds left to go, and this was like the regional tournament. And he just crouched down on the floor. I mean, I don't know if he was crying or not, but it looked like he was. And I just dropped down on my knees right next to him with a wide angle and got a shot. And here he is with the other team dancing around in the background and this poor player right before him. I got more comments on that picture just from people. It was either, what a great shot, or how could you do this to this kid? But the other losing picture was Newark Catholic had gone over to, I think it was a state championship game in football, and they lost by like 1 point. And as they were walking off the field, I followed the coach. And here's this picture of him sort of head down, walking off the field with the scoreboard right in the background, which, you know, That was it.
That one.
That was, you know, and I, once again, I got positive and negative comments on that just over and over again. People who remembered that picture for either because they really loved it or they really hated it. So, but, and actually, favorite shots from the Advocate, there are two of them that I think of immediately. About the second assignment that I ever did, I went to Bring Your Pet Day at one of the elementary schools. Had the most wonderful picture of this kid with his big cat sitting up on the, you know, exercise or the jungle gym or whatever. And it was a delightful photo, and I've never done a better kid photo since then, I don't think. And the other one that, there are two other ones. One would be at a place called Legend Valley out here. Anybody who's from Newark knows where that is. They had a whole series of concerts, and I had the joy of photographing AC/DC and Scorpions and Alabama, and I forget all who else was out there. But the one show that really mattered was Willie Nelson. Now, I'm not a country fan. I don't know anything about his music, and to be honest, I don't really care. But as an entertainer, the man is amazing. And what was more amazing was I talked to his stage manager and said, listen, the picture I really need is Willie on the stage with 50,000 people, because there really were 50,000 people out there in this field listening to him. The stage manager says, come with me. And he walked around and led me up to the drummer's platform, put me right next to the drummer. Drummer looks up, big smile on his face, and says, hey, you know, welcome to our stage. And the stage manager came up and held my belt, hung on so I wouldn't fall off, as I stood there and shot this wide-angle shot of 50,000 people and Willie Nelson. And I was really impressed with that. I thought, if this stage manager, here he is, you know, Willie Nelson is a big deal. And if his stage manager is kind enough to do that for me, I'm feeling pretty special about it. And it made a special picture.
Those were the days.
Yeah.
That stuff doesn't happen anymore.
No, it doesn't, unfortunately.
Yeah.
However, the other picture, and Dave will appreciate this, I like motor drives. I've always loved motor drives. And he's thinking of one picture. I'm thinking of another one. About 6 months after I started at the Advocate, I really had it in my head that I wanted to do some basketball pictures of Newark High School was doing very well that year. And I had this idea, I'll go put a camera behind a glass backboard and take some pictures. Well, that didn't work. There was too much vibration and the camera was bouncing around and didn't really work. And then I tried mounting them higher up in the bracket behind the basket. This was like a 3-week adventure. And that didn't work because there was so much, the basket swayed so much that the clamps that I used actually let go. I was afraid one of them was going to fall. And so I talked to the people at Newark High School and I said, listen, this is what I want to do. I want to build a brace and put it all the way across up near the ceiling, mount cameras up there so they're up away from the backboard itself, and, you know, straight down shot. And they said, well, if you want to do it, fine, but, you know, you can put the cameras up there before the game. You can't have them until after the game is completely over. And so that's what we did, and it's the resulting photo of Mike Giomi, who went on to play for Indiana or whatever, is still on my website because it worked. Yeah. I don't know if it's worked that well since then, but that one worked. But
you remind me of a story Steve Pyle told me about shooting basketball down at OU and the. Before they built the big domed stadium or arena, where they had catwalks that you could get up above the floor, and I think you could get up on top of a scoreboard, Mm-hmm. And the photographers would sit on top of a scoreboard, if I remember right, and shoot from there until one time during a game, a 105 got dropped on the court. And a technical foul was called on OU, and the all the gang planks or whatever they were, the walkways up there were henceforth and forevermore closed to photographers.
Well, a similar thing happened up at the Cavaliers at Richfield Coliseum. They had a wonderful series of these catwalks that were probably 80 or 100 feet above the floor. And one time I wanted to go up there and do an overhead shot, which it didn't really work out very well. But they said, sure, you can go up there. You can set all the cameras you want. They said, but you're not allowed to be up there during the game because someone had gone up and dropped a lens. Yeah. I was like, ooh.
Yeah, not a good thing.
That would be a deadly thing.
Any memories of Steve Pyle?
Steve Pyle was here when I was in high school. And I remember one time he came up to WGSF television, our student television station, and did a program on photography. And what fascinated me was his Nikon F. I'd never handled a real camera like that. Actually, I think he had an F2. And it was like, wow. But it was always neat to, after he left here, he was working for AP. And, you know, I would see his pictures and not really know it. But then when I was at the Advocate, I would see the wire photos coming over from Milwaukee. He was shooting the Milwaukee Bucks. And it was like, Steve Pyle. It's like, I know this guy. You know, I didn't really work with him. I mean, I just, you know, he was an inspiration to us high school kids, you know, because basically, from our perspective, he'd seen it all and done it all. I don't know whether he did or not, but, you know,
he'd tell you he did.
Well,
he
whatever.
If you ever heard him tell his stories, he had been everywhere and done everything. That
and was there
one of the things that was about Steve.
When I was at the Advocate, there was still the sense that the ideas that he had instilled in the photo department or in the newspaper itself were still valid, you know, in terms of what was a news photo and what wasn't. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that has died off since then, unfortunately.
Yeah. You didn't work with him at AP then?
It was funny because he was always, I think actually by the time I was in Chicago, I think he'd already passed away at that point in time.
Yeah.
You know, we never actually worked directly. His replacement in Milwaukee was somebody I worked with a lot, but I never worked with him.
Yeah. But was Bruce Humphrey at the Advocate when you were there?
He was already long gone by the time I got to the Advocate, unfortunately. The only real leftover from the previous administration was Gary Smith.
Yeah.
And Gary and I had a wonderful, wonderful time working together there for, what, 3 or 4 years, however many years I was at the Advocate. Mm-hmm. It was a very good fit because, first of all, we were both gadget guys, and so, you know, we'd sort of like try and out-gadget each other. But he had a very similar attitude about photography and about, you know, the same sort of thing that we were talking about Pyle, where there was a very clear sense of what was a news photo and what wasn't. A very clear sense of what was suitable for the paper and what wasn't. And what was worth fighting for and what wasn't. And I think, you know, because Gary and I saw eye to eye on so many of those things, it just made it really, really easy to work with him.
Can you put into words what makes a news photo and what doesn't?
Yeah, well, it's real simple. It better be in focus. The only The only exception that anybody's ever told me to that is if you've got the bullet in the air heading towards the president, that one's allowed to be out of focus, okay? Otherwise, it better be sharp. But more importantly, a composition that the picture by itself can stand by itself. And that's sometimes easier said than done, especially when you're at the mercy of a news event. You know, you're out there and slogging away, taking pictures of for the 400th time, you're taking a picture of, you know, some event. And it's like, how am I going to make this picture worth anything? But the other important thing, especially back in the days with the Advocate and the marginal reproduction that sometimes happened, was you had to have a big face. I forget who it was said if the face was small enough that you could cover it with a nickel, I think it was, then it wasn't worth putting into paper. Mm-hmm. But then the other problem there is then you have to have their name, right, if they're that big.
Right.
So
it's always,
you know, so it was a combination of getting the picture but also getting the name. Right. And I learned a lot at the Advocate about doing that, which to this day, you know, I still think in terms of, okay, I've got this wonderful picture. I better figure out who these people are.
Yeah, get the IDs.
Get the IDs. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a, you know, a full-blown release or something like that, but you better have their name. If it's a child under the age of 18, you better have their age and what town they're from.
Yeah, when I started, we ran, you had to have your parents' name and address. And that often got kind of dicey if there was only one parent. That was an issue back then that has vanished. And you had to have Miss or Mrs. For the mother. You know, or it was Mrs. John Smith.
Right, very formal. Yeah.
All that.
Well, actually, the thing that has tripped me up time and time again is, you know, you go out and here's, you know, John Doe and his wife, Mary Smith, and the children, little Mikey Knickenbocker, you know. It's right. Like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You know? And so you have to ask, even
right.
though, you know, you think, oh, well, here's the lovely John Doe family. Well, yes, but every single one of them's got a different name, and you better have them right.
Yeah.
So I always ask, you know, even though sometimes it seems kind of awkward, you know, you think, oh, well, you know, this is a typical American family. Well, yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. I remember getting nasty notes from Bruce Humphrey. No nicknames.
Oh.
It couldn't be Tim Black. It had to be Timothy Black.
I see. Okay.
Even with kids.
Yeah. Or somebody who comes up and says, yeah, my name is J.R. Okay, what's your real name? It's J.R.
Yeah.
Okay, whatever.
There was always that.
Yeah. And some of them, actually, that was their name.
Yeah.
But, it's so long ago now, relatively speaking, you know, that I try and think back, okay, what were the things that, you know, that I enjoyed the most at the Advocate. And the county fair was a lot of work. It was a lot of work because the county fairgrounds are as far away from Newark as you can possibly go. And yet you had to make two trips a day. Go up first thing in the morning, go up last thing at night, and you know, I was like, okay, do I really want to do this? But it always made nice pictures. And you got to know some of the most incredible people. You know, even though it was the same people every year, You know, I mean, the same people have been showing their cows for, you know, 150 right. years. You know, they still, you always met somebody new and somebody interesting. So the county fair was always a lot of fun. One thing that we always went out to photograph, and this was sort of a holdover from the good old days, I always took a picture when someone turned 100 years old.
Yeah.
I don't know how many people I went out and took a picture of them turning 100 years old. And I can tell you probably 95% of them said exactly the same thing when the reporter said, "What's your secret to living so long?" And virtually every single one of them said, "I have a beer every night after dinner." I can't believe how many of them actually said that. But, you know, maybe that was the secret to success. Yeah. There was something else that Gary Smith impressed upon me, and made a big impression on me. You know, we would go to these senior centers or, you know, maybe go to somebody's 100th birthday or whatever. And Gary reminded me one time, he says, "Listen," he says, "you know, it may seem, you know, not a big deal to take a picture, but the picture you take of this senior citizen or this older person might be the best picture, the best last picture that exists of them."
Right.
And so don't take it lightly, you know. I mean, make it count. And so I do remember that, you know, when I think, you know, yeah, take an extra 10 seconds, take an extra minute and make it good, you know, because that may be the last one. Or it may be the last good one,
right?
You know, and they will treasure it, you know, for the remaining years of their lives. So,
and their family after.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And so that was something that, you know, I didn't really think that much of it until Gary said that, and it's like, oh yeah, you know, he's right. So,
want to toss in a John Alley story? You got one of those?
My favorite John Alley story, and I told Dave this a while back. High school basketball was always a real struggle here at the Advocate because there was this expectation that you could go to two or three or even four games on a Friday night. I had at work, this is back to the Mario Andretti, you know, sort of mode of photography. I had it worked out so, you know, I would go as far out in the county as I could go, North Ridge or Utica or Johnstown or whatever. Go out, shoot the first quarter of a basketball game, and then drive like mad and get to, you know, another location, you know, whether it be, you know, say if you started in you know, Utica, you might be able to go to, say, to Licking Valley or whatever. You could go one other place and get there before halftime and make a picture. And then you'd pack up at halftime and run to, like, Newark, for instance. One night, Newark High School was playing, and this was when I was in high school. Newark High School was playing, it wasn't New Concord, it was Cambridge. Cambridge had played Zanesville the night before and got killed, like 50-20 or something like that. And the week before, we had played Zanesville and we beat them something like 65-50 or whatever. So the Cambridge team came in thinking the only way they could beat us was by stalling. They had this game plan that they were going to come in and they were going to get the first basket of each quarter, and they thought they would win 8-6. Well, and unfortunately, Newark got the first basket. And so Cambridge came up, and they decided they were going to continue with this game plan. So here they are, stalling. The whole game, they stalled. It got so bad that the referees were joking with the audience. Players, except for the two who were passing the ball back and forth, sat down on the floor. And, you know, they sat together, you know. It was hilarious to watch. But you're thinking, what? When are they going to play the game? In the middle of all this, in runs John. And he came in expecting, you know, as I did several years later, you know, when I was shooting for The Advocate, John comes running in, and he sits down next to me with this look on his face like, what in the world is going on here? And you know, it's like, I can imagine what was going through his head. It's like, how am I going to make a picture? Because I have to get a picture and get out of here. And I think he stuck around for about 15 minutes. And I always wondered, what picture did he make? Because I forget what I ended up shooting that night. I think I was shooting the guys giggling. You know, I didn't even shoot any action. But I looked when they had the little memorial service for John. I looked in on the microfilms of The Advocate, and sure enough, there was one basket actually scored during the time he was there, during the 15 minutes he was there, and he's got a picture of this guy going up to shoot the basket. It's like, I couldn't believe it. So, yeah, that I just remember the look on his face as he walked in there, because it was like, holy cow, what is going on here? It's pretty funny.
Thank you, Tim. I think we got something there to put on the website. Let's try to take a picture now.
Oh, no. No pictures. No pictures.